act in to sip beers and nibble popcorn at the place owned by Lance Nicholas Dunn, the maybe killer. Go had to hire 4 new kids to tend the bar. She'd dropped by once and said she couldn't go again. Couldn't stand seeing how packed it was. Fucking gawkers, ghouls, all drinking our booze and swapping stories about me. It was disgusting. Still, Go reasoned, the money would be helpful if... if. Amy gone 6 days, and we were all thinking in ifs. We approached the park in a car gone silent except for Mary Beth's constant nail drumming on the window.
Feels almost like a double date,
Rand laughed, the laughter curving toward the hysterical, high-pitched and squeaky. Rand Elliott, genius psychologist, best-selling author, friend to all, was unraveling. Marybeth had taken to self-medication, shots of clear liquor administered with absolute precision, enough to take the edge off, but stay sharp. Rand, on the other hand, was literally losing his head. I half expected to see it shoot off his shoulders on a jack-in-the-box spring. Cuckoo! Rand's schmoozy nature had turned manic. He got desperately chummy with everyone he met, wrapping his arms around cops, reporters, volunteers. He was particularly tight with our Days Inn liaison, a gawky shy kid named Donnie, whom Rand liked to razz and inform he was doing so.
I'm just razzing you, Donnie, he'd say.
And Donnie would break into a joyous grin. Can't that kid go get validation somewhere else? I groused to Go the other night. She said I was just jealous that my father figure liked someone better. I was. Mary Beth patted Rand's back as we walked toward the park, and I thought about how much I wanted someone to do that. Just a quick touch, and I suddenly let out a gasp sob. One quick, teary moan. I wanted someone, but I wasn't sure if it was Andy or Amy. Nick? Go said. She raised a hand toward my shoulder, but I shrugged her off.
Sorry. Wow, sorry for that, I said.
Weird outburst. Very undunny. No problem. We're both coming undunny, Go said, and looked away. Since discovering my situation, which is what we'd taken to calling my infidelity, she'd gotten a bit removed, her eyes distant, her face a constant mole. I was trying very hard not to resent it. As we entered the park, the camera crews were everywhere, not just local anymore, but network. The Duns and the Elliots walked along the perimeter of the crowd, Rand smiling and nodding like a visiting dignitary. Boney and Gilpin appeared almost immediately, took to our heels like friendly pointer dogs. They were becoming familiar, furniture, which was clearly the idea. Boney was wearing the same clothes she wore to any public event, a sensible black skirt, a gray striped blouse, barrettes clipping either side of her limp hair. I got a girl named Boney Maroney. The night was steamy. Under each of Boney's armpits was a dark smiley face of perspiration. She actually grinned at me, as if yesterday the accusations, they were accusations, weren't they, hadn't happened. The Elliots and I filed up the steps to a rickety makeshift stage. I looked back toward my twin, and she nodded at me and pantomimed a big breath, and I remembered to breathe. Hundreds of faces were turned toward us, along with clicking, flashing cameras. Don't smile, I told myself. Do not smile. From the front of dozens of Find Amy t-shirts, my wife studied me. Goh had said I needed to make a speech. You need some humanizing fast. So I did. I walked up to the microphone. It was too low, mid-belly, and I wrestled with it a few seconds, and it raised only an inch. The kind of malfunction that would normally infuriate me, but I could no longer be infuriated in public. So I took a breath and leaned down and read the words that my sister had written for me. My wife, Amy Dunn, has been missing for almost a week. I cannot possibly convey the anguish our family feels, the deep hole in our lives left by Amy's disappearance. Amy is the love of my life. She is the heart of her family. For those who have yet to meet her, she is funny and charming and kind. She is wise and warm. She is my helpmate and partner in every way. I looked up into the crowd and, like magic, spotted Andy, a disgusted look on her face, and I quickly glanced back at my notes. Amy is the woman I want to grow old with, and I know this will happen. Pause. Breathe. No smile. Goh had actually written the words on my index card. Happen. 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 My voice echoed out through the speakers, rolling toward the river. We ask you to contact us with any information. We light candles tonight in the hope she comes home soon and safely. I love you, Amy. I kept my eyes moving anywhere but Andy. The park sparkled with candles. A moment of silence was supposed to be observed, but babies were crying, and one stumbling homeless man kept asking loudly, "Hey, what is this about? What's it for?" And someone would whisper Amy's name, and the guy would say louder, "What? It's for what?" From the middle of the crowd, Noelle Hawthorne began moving forward, her triplets affixed, one on a hip, the other two clinging to her skirt, all looking ludicrously tiny to a man who spent no time around children. Noelle forced the crowd to part for her and the children, marching right to the edge of the podium, where she looked up at me. I glared at her. The woman had maligned me, and then I noticed for the first time the swell in her belly, and realized she was pregnant again. For one second, my mouth dropped. 4 kids under 4, sweet Jesus! And later, that look would be analyzed and debated, most people believing it was a 1-2 punch of anger and fear. "Hey, Nick!" Her voice caught in the half-raised microphone and boomed out to the audience. I started to fumble with the mic, but couldn't find the off switch. "I just wanted to see your face," she said, and burst into tears. A wet sob rolled out over the audience. Everyone rapt. "Where is she? What have you done with Amy? What have you done with your wife? Wife, wife," her voice echoed. 2 of her alarmed children began to wail. Noelle couldn't talk for a second. She was crying so hard. She was wild, furious, and she grabbed the microphone stand and yanked the whole thing down to her level. I debated grabbing it back, but knew I could do nothing toward this woman in the maternity dress with the 3 toddlers. I scanned the crowd for Mike Hawthorne. "Control your wife." But he was nowhere. Noelle turned to address the crowd. "I am Amy's best friend. 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 The words boomed out all over the park along with her children's keening.
Despite my best efforts, the police don't seem to be taking me seriously. So I'm taking our cause to this town that Amy loved, that loved her back. This man, Nick Dunn, needs to answer some questions. He needs to tell us what he did to his wife.
Boney darted from the side of the stage to reach her, and Noelle turned, and the two locked eyes. Boney made a frantic chopping motion at her throat.
Stop talking. His pregnant wife.
And no one could see the candles anymore, because the flashbulbs were going berserk. Next to me, Rand made a noise like a balloon squeak. Down below me, Boney put her fingers between her eyebrows as if stanching a headache. I was seeing everyone in frantic strobe shots that matched my pulse. I looked out into the crowd for Andy, saw her staring at me, her face pink and twisted, her cheeks damp. And as we caught each other's eyes, she mouthed, "Asshole," and stumbled back away through the crowd.
"We should go,"
my sister, suddenly beside me, whispering in my ear, tugging at my arm. The cameras flashing at me as I stood like some Frankenstein's monster, fearful and agitated by the villager torches.
"Flash! Flash!"
We started moving, breaking into two parts, my sister and I fleeing toward Go's car, the Elliots standing with jaws agape on the platform, left behind, save yourselves. The reporters pelted the question over and over at me.
"Nick, was Amy pregnant? Nick, were you upset Amy was pregnant?"
Me streaking out of the park, ducking like I was caught in hail.
"Pregnant, pregnant. Pregnant,"
the word pulsing in the summer night, in time to the cicadas.
Amy Elliott Dunn, February 15th, 2012. Diary entry. What a strange time this is. I have to think that way, try to examine it from a distance. Ha ha! What an odd period this will be to look back on. Won't I be amused when I'm 80, dressed in faded lavender, a wise, amused figure swilling martinis, and won't this make a story? A strange, awful story of something I survived. Because something is horribly wrong with my husband. Of that I am sure now. Yes, he's mourning his mother, but this is something more. It feels directed at me. Not a sadness, but I can feel him watching me sometimes, and I look up and see his face twisted in disgust. Like he's walked in on me doing something awful, instead of just eating cereal in the morning or combing my hair at night. He is so angry, so unstable. I've been wondering if his moods are linked to something physical. One of those wheat allergies that turn people mad, or a colony of mold spores that has clogged his brain. I came downstairs the other night and found him at the dining room table, his head in his hands, looking at a pile of credit card bills. I watched my husband, all alone under the spotlight of a chandelier. I wanted to go to him, to sit down with him and figure it out like partners. But I didn't. I knew that would piss him off. I sometimes wonder if that is at the root of his distaste for me. He's let me see his shortcomings, and he hates me for knowing them. He shoved me. Hard. 2 days ago, he shoved me, and I fell and banged my head against the kitchen island, and I couldn't see for 3 seconds. I don't really know what to say about it. It was more shocking than painful. I was telling him I could get a job, something freelance, so we could start a family, have a real life. "What do you call this?" he said. "Purgatory," I thought. I stayed silent. "What do you call this, Amy? Huh? What do you call this? This isn't life, according to Miss Amazing?" "It's not my idea of life," I said. And he took 3 big steps toward me, and I thought, he looks like he's going to... And then he was slamming against me, and I was falling. We both gasped. He held his fist in the other hand and looked like he might cry. He was beyond sorry. He was aghast. But here's the thing I want to be clear on. I knew what I was doing. I was punching every button on him. I was watching him coil tighter and tighter. I wanted him to finally say something, do something. Even if it's bad, even if it's the worst, do something, Nick. Don't leave me here like a ghost. I just didn't realize he was going to do that. I've never considered what I would do if my husband attacked me, because I haven't exactly run in the wife-beating crowd. I know, Lifetime movie, I know. Violence crosses all socioeconomic barriers. But still, Nick? I sound glib. It just seems so incredibly ludicrous. I am a battered wife. Amazing Amy and the domestic abuser. He did apologize profusely. Does anyone do anything profusely except apologize? Sweat, I guess. He's agreed to consider counseling, which is something I never thought could happen, which is good. He's such a good man at his core that I am willing to write it off, to believe it truly was a sick anomaly brought on by the strain we're both under. I forget sometimes that as much stress as I feel, Nick feels it too. He bears the burden of having brought me here. He feels the strain of wanting mopey me to be content, and for a man like Nick, who believes strongly in an up-by-the-bootstrap sort of happiness, that can be infuriating. So the hard shove, so quick, then done, it didn't scare me in itself. What scared me was the look on his face as I lay on the floor blinking, my head ringing. It was the look on his face as he restrained himself from taking another jab. How much he wanted to shove me again. How hard it was not to. How he's been looking at me since. Guilt and disgust at the guilt. Absolute disgust. Here's the darkest part. I drove out to the mall yesterday, where about half the town buys drugs, and it's as easy as picking up a prescription. I know because Noelle told me. Her husband goes there to purchase the occasional joint. I didn't want a joint, though. I wanted a gun, just in case things with Nick go really wrong. I didn't realize until I was almost there that it was Valentine's Day. It was Valentine's Day, and I was going to buy a gun and then cook my husband dinner. And I thought to myself, Nick's dad was right about you. You are a dumb bitch. Because if you think your husband is going to hurt you, you leave. And yet you can't leave your husband who's mourning his dead mother. You can't. You'd have to be a biblically awful woman to do that. Unless something were truly wrong. You'd have to really believe your husband was going to hurt you. But I don't really think Nick would hurt me. I just would feel safer with a gun.
Nick Dunn. 6 days gone. Go pushed me into the car and peeled away from the park. We flew past Noelle, who was walking with Boney and Gilpin toward their cruiser, her carefully dressed triplets bumping along behind her like kite ribbons. We screeched past the mob, Hundreds of faces, a fleshy pointillism of anger aimed right at me. We ran away, basically. Technically.
Wow, ambush, Go muttered.
Ambush? I repeated, brain stunned.
You think that was an accident, Nick? Triplet cunt already made her statement to the police. Nothing about the pregnancy.
Or they're doling out bombshells a little at a time. Boney and Gilpin had already heard my wife was pregnant and decided to make it a strategy. They clearly really believed I killed her.
Noelle will be on every cable broadcast for the next week, talking about how you're a murderer and she's Amy's best friend out for justice. Publicity whore. Publicity fucking whore.
I pressed my face against the window, slumped in my chair. Several news vans followed us. We drove silently, Go's breath slowing down. I watched the river, a tree branch bobbing its way south.
Nick?
She finally said.
Is it... Do you...
I don't know, Go. Amy didn't say anything to me. If she was pregnant, why would she tell Noelle and not tell me?
Why would she try to get a gun and not tell you? Go said. None of this makes sense.
We retreated to Go's. The camera crews would be swarming my house, and as soon as I walked in the door, my cell phone rang. The real one. It was the Elliots. I sucked in some air, ducked into my old bedroom, then answered.
I need to ask you this, Nick.
It was Rand, the TV burbling in the background.
I need you to tell me. Did you know Amy was pregnant?
I paused, trying to find the right way to phrase it, the unlikelihood of a pregnancy.
Answer me, goddammit!
Rand's volume made me get quieter. I spoke in a soft, soothing voice, a voice wearing a cardigan. Amy and I were not trying to get pregnant. She didn't want to be pregnant, Rand. I don't know if she ever was going to be. We weren't even having relations that often. I'd be very surprised if she was pregnant.
Noelle said Amy visited the doctor to confirm the pregnancy. The police already submitted a subpoena for the records. We'll know tonight.
I found Go in the living room, sitting with a cup of cold coffee at my mother's card table. She turned toward me just enough to show she knew I was there, but she didn't let me see her face.
Why do you keep lying, Nick?
She asked. The Elliots are not your enemy. Shouldn't you at least tell them that it was you who didn't want kids? Why make Amy look like the bad guy? I swallowed the rage again. My stomach was hot with it.
I'm exhausted, Go. God damn. We gotta do this now.
We gonna find a time that's better?
I did want kids. We tried for a while, no luck. We even started looking into fertility treatments. But then Amy decided she didn't want kids.
You told me you didn't.
I was trying to put a good face on it.
Oh, awesome. Another lie, Go said. I didn't realize you were such a... What you're saying, Nick? It makes no sense.
I was there at the dinner to celebrate the bar, and Mom misunderstood. She thought you guys were announcing that you were pregnant, and it made Amy cry. Well, I can't explain everything Amy ever did, Go. I don't know why, a fucking year ago, she cried like that. Okay?
Go sat quietly, the orange of the streetlight creating a rock star halo around her profile.
"This is going to be a real test for you, Nick," she murmured, not looking at me. "You've always had trouble with the truth. You always do the little fib if you think it will avoid a real argument. You've always gone the easy way. Tell Mom you went to baseball practice when you really quit the team. Tell Mom you went to church when you were at a movie. It's some weird compulsion."
"This is very different from baseball, Go."
"It's a lot different, but you're still fibbing like a little boy. You're still desperate to have everyone think you're perfect. You never want to be the bad guy. So you tell Amy's parents she didn't want kids. You don't tell me you're cheating on your wife. You swear the credit cards in your name aren't yours. You swear you were hanging out at a beach when you hate the beach. You swear your marriage was happy. I just don't know what to believe right now."
"You're kidding, right?"
"Since Amy has disappeared, all you've done is lie. It makes me worry about what's going on."
Complete silence for a moment. "Go, are you saying what I think you're saying? Because if you are, something has fucking died between us."
"Remember that game you always played with Mom when we were little? Would you still love me if... would you still love me if I smacked Go? Would you still love me if I robbed a bank? Would you still love me if I killed someone?"
I said nothing. My breath was coming too fast.
"I would still love you," Go said.
"Go, do you really need me to say it?" She stayed silent. "I did not kill Amy." She stayed silent. "Do you believe me?" I asked.
"I love you."
She put her hand on my shoulder and went to her bedroom, shut the door. I waited to see the light go on in the room, but it stayed dark. 2 seconds later, my cell phone rang. This time it was the disposable cell that I needed to get rid of and couldn't, because I always, always, always had to pick up for Andy.
"Once a day, Nick. We need to talk once a day."
I realized I was grinding my teeth. I took a breath. Far out on the edge of town were the remains of an old West fort that was now yet another park that no one ever went to. All that was left was the 2-story wooden watchtower, surrounded by rusted swing sets and teeter-totters. Andy and I had met there once, groping each other inside the shade of the watchtower. I did 3 long loops around town in my mom's old car to be sure I was not tracked. It was madness to go. It wasn't yet 10 o'clock, but I had no say in our rendezvous anymore.
"I need to see you, Nick, tonight, right now, or I swear to you, I will lose it."
As I pulled up to the fort, I was hit by the remoteness of it and what it meant. Andy was still willing to meet me in a lonely, unlit place. Me, the pregnant wife killer. As I walked toward the tower through the thick, scratchy grass, I could just see her outline in the tiny window of the wooden watchtower. "She is going to undo you, Nick." I quick-stepped the rest of the way. An hour later, I was huddled in my paparazzi-infested house, waiting. Rand said they'd know before midnight whether my wife was pregnant. When the phone rang, I grabbed it immediately, only to find it was goddamn Comfort Hill. My father was gone again. The cops had been notified.
As always, they made it sound as if I were the jackass. If this happens again, we are going to have to terminate your father's stay with us. I had a sickening chill. My dad moving in with me. Two pathetic, angry bastards. It would surely make for the worst buddy comedy in the world. The ending would be a murder-suicide. Ba-da-dum! Cue the laugh track. I was getting off the phone, peering out the back window at the river. Stay calm, Nick. When I saw a huddled figure down by the boathouse. I thought it must be a stray reporter, but then I recognized something in those bald fists and tight shoulders. Comfort Hill was about a 30-minute walk straight down River Road. He somehow remembered our house when he couldn't remember me. I went outside into the darkness to see him dangling a foot over the bank, staring into the river. Less bedraggled than before, although he smelled tangy with sweat. Dad, what are you doing here? Everyone's worried. He looked at me with dark brown eyes, sharp eyes, not the glazed milk color some elderly acquire. It would have been less disconcerting if they'd been milky.
She told me to come, he snapped. She told me to come. This is my house. I can come whenever I want.
You walked all the way here?
I can come here any time. You may hate me, but she loves me.
I almost laughed. Even my father was reinventing a relationship with Amy. A few photographers on my front lawn began shooting. I had to get my dad back to the home. I could picture the article they'd have to cook up to go along with this exclusive footage. What kind of father was Bill Dunn? What kind of man did he raise? Good God, if my dad started in on one of his harangues against the bitches. I dialed Comfort Hill, and after some finagling, they sent an orderly to retrieve him. I made a display of walking him gently to the sedan, murmuring reassuringly as the photographers got their shots. My dad. I smiled as he left. I tried to make it seem very proud son. The reporters asked me if I killed my wife. I was retreating to the house when a cop car pulled up. It was Boney who came to my home, braving the paparazzi, to tell me. She did it kindly, in a gentle fingertip voice. Amy was pregnant. My wife was gone, with my baby inside her. Boney watched me, waiting for my reaction. Make it part of the police report. So I told myself, act correctly, don't blow it. Act the way a man acts when he hears this news. I ducked my head into my hands and muttered, Oh God, oh God. And while I was doing it, I saw my wife on the floor of our kitchen, her hands around her belly, and her head bashed in.
Amy Elliott Dunn, June 26, 2012. Diary entry. I have never felt more alive in my life. It is a bright, blue sky day. The birds are lunatic with the warmth. The river outside is gushing past, and I am utterly alive. Scared, thrilled, but alive. This morning, when I woke up, Nick was gone. I sat in bed staring at the ceiling, watching the sun golden it a foot at a time, the bluebirds singing right outside our window, and I wanted to vomit. My throat was clenching and unclenching like a heart. I told myself I would not throw up. Then I ran to the bathroom and threw up. Bile and warm water and one small bobbing pee. As my stomach was seizing and my eyes were tearing and I was gasping for breath, I started doing the only kind of math a woman does, huddled over a toilet. I'm on the pill, but I'd also forgotten a day or two. What does it matter? I'm 38. I've been on the pill for almost 2 decades. I'm not going to accidentally get pregnant. I found the tests behind a locked sheet of glass. I had to track down a harried, mustached woman to unlock the case and point out one I wanted while she waited impatiently. She handed it to me with a clinical stare and said, "Good luck." I didn't know what would be good luck, plus sign or minus sign. I drove home and read the directions 3 times, and I held the stick at the right angle for the right number of seconds, and then I set it on the edge of the sink and ran away like it was a bomb. 3 minutes, so I turned on the radio, and of course it was a Tom Petty song. Is there ever a time you turn on the radio and don't hear a Tom Petty song? So I sang every word to American Girl, and then I crept back into the bathroom like the test was something I had to sneak up on, my heart beating more frantically than it should, and I was pregnant. I was suddenly running across the summer lawn and down the street, banging on Noelle's door, and when she opened it, I burst into tears and showed her the stick and yelled, "I'm pregnant!" And then someone else besides me knew, and so I was scared. Once I got back home, I had 2 thoughts. One, our anniversary is coming next week. I will use the clues as love letters, a beautiful, antique, wooden cradle waiting at the end. I will convince him we belong together, as a family. Two, I wish I'd been able to get that gun. I get frightened now, sometimes, when my husband gets home. A few weeks ago, Nick asked me to go out on the raft with him, float along in the current under a blue sky. I actually wrapped my hands around our newel post when he asked me this. I clung to it. Because I had an image of him wobbling the raft, teasing at first, laughing at my panic, and then his face going tight, determined, and me falling into the water, that muddy, brown water, scratchy with sticks and sand, and him on top of me, holding me under with one strong arm until I stopped struggling. I can't help it. Nick married me when I was a young, rich, beautiful woman, and now I am poor, jobless, closer to 40 than 30. I'm not just pretty anymore. I am pretty for my age. It is the truth. My value has decreased. I can tell by the way Nick looks at me. But it's not the look of a guy who took a tumble on an honest bet. It's the look of a man who feels swindled. Soon, it may be the look of a man who is trapped. He might have been able to divorce me before the baby, but he would never do that now, not good guy Nick. He couldn't bear to have everyone in this family values town believe he's the kind of guy who'd abandon his wife and child. He'd rather stay and suffer with me. Suffer and resent and rage. I won't have an abortion. The baby is 6 weeks in my belly today, the size of a lentil, and is growing eyes and lungs and ears. A few hours ago, I went into the kitchen and found a snap-top container of dried beans Maureen had given me for Nick's favorite soup, and I pulled out a lentil and laid it on the counter. It was smaller than my pinky nail, tiny. I couldn't bear to leave it on the cold countertop, so I picked it up and held it in my palm and petted it with the tip, tip, tip of a finger. Now it's in the pocket of my t-shirt, so I can keep it close. I won't get an abortion, and I won't divorce Nick, not yet, because I can still remember how he'd dive into the ocean on a summer day and stand on his hands, his legs flailing out of the water, and leap back up with the best seashell just for me. And I'd let my eyes get dazzled by the sun, and I'd shut them and see the colors blinking like raindrops on the inside of my eyelids as Nick kissed me with salty lips, and I'd think, I am so lucky. This is my husband. This man will be the father of my children. We'll all be so happy. But I may be wrong. I may be very wrong. Because sometimes, the way he looks at me, that sweet boy from the beach, man of my dreams, father of my child, I catch him looking at me with those watchful eyes, the eyes of an insect, pure calculation, and I think, this man might kill me. So, if you find this, and I'm dead, well, sorry, that's not funny.
Nick Dunn, 7 days gone. It was time. At exactly 8 a.m. Central, 9 a.m. New York time, I picked up my phone. My wife was definitely pregnant. I was definitely the prime, only, suspect. I was going to get a lawyer today, and he was going to be the very lawyer I didn't want and absolutely needed. Tanner Bolt. A grim necessity. Flip around any of the legal networks, the true crime shows, and Tanner Bolt's spray-tanned face would pop up, indignant and concerned on behalf of whatever freak show client he was representing. He became famous at 34 for representing Cody Olson, a Chicago restaurateur accused of strangling his very pregnant wife and dumping her body in a landfill. Corpse dogs detected the scent of a dead body inside the trunk of Cody's Mercedes. A search of his laptop revealed that someone had printed out a map to the nearest landfill the morning Cody's wife went missing. A no-brainer. By the time Tanner Bolt was done, everyone, the police department, two West Side Chicago gang members, a disgruntled club bouncer, was implicated except Cody Olson, who walked out of the courtroom and bought cocktails all around. In the decades since, Tanner Bolt had become known as the Hubby Hawk. His specialty was swooping down in high-profile cases to represent men accused of murdering their wives. He was successful over half the time, which wasn't bad, considering the cases were usually damning, the accused extremely unlikable, cheaters, narcissists, sociopaths. Tanner Bolt's other nickname was Dickhead Defender. I had a 2 p.m. appointment.
This is Mary Beth Elliott. Please leave a message, and I will return promptly, she said in a voice just like Amy's. Amy, who would not return promptly.
I was speeding to the airport to fly to New York and meet with Tanner Bolt. When I'd asked Boney's permission to leave town, she seemed amused. Cops don't really do that. That's just on TV.
Hi, Mary Beth. It's Nick again. I'm anxious to talk to you. I wanted to tell you, I truly didn't know about the pregnancy. I'm just as shocked as you must be. Also, I'm hiring an attorney, just so you know. I think even Rand had suggested it, so anyway, you know how bad I am on messages. I hope you call me back.
Tanner Bolt's office was in Midtown, not far from where I used to work. The elevator shot me up 25 stories, but it was so smooth that I wasn't sure I was moving until my ears popped. At the 26th floor, a tight-lipped blonde in a sleek business suit stepped on. She tapped her foot impatiently, waiting for the doors to shut, then snapped at me, "Why don't you hit close?" I flashed her the smile I give petulant women, the lighten-up smile, the one Amy called the beloved Nikki grin, and then the woman recognized me.
Oh, she said. She looked as if she smelled something rancid. She seemed personally vindicated when I scuttled out on Tanner's floor. This guy was the best, and I needed the best, but I also resented being associated with him in any way. This sleaze bag, this showboat, this attorney to the guilty. I pre-hated Tanner Bolt so much that I expected his office to look like a Miami Vice set. But Bolt and Bolt was quite the opposite. It was dignified, lawyerly. Behind spotless glass doors, people in very good suits commuted busily between offices. A young, pretty man with a tie the color of tropical fruit greeted me and settled me down in the shiny glass and mirror reception area and grandly offered water, declined, then went back to a gleaming desk and picked up a gleaming phone. I sat on the sofa, watching the skyline, cranes pecking up and down like mechanical birds. Then I unfolded Amy's final clue from my pocket. 5 years is wood. Was that going to be the end prize of the treasure hunt? Something for the baby? A carved oak cradle? A wooden rattle? Something for our baby and for us to start over. The Duns redone. Go phoned while I was still staring at the clue. Are we okay? She asked immediately. My sister thought I was possibly a wife killer. Or as okay as I think we can ever be again, considering. Nick, I'm sorry. I called to say I'm sorry, Go said. I woke up and felt totally insane and awful. I lost my head. It was a momentary freak out. I really, truly apologize. I remained silent. You've got to give me this, Nick. Exhaustion and stress and... I'm sorry. Truly. Okay, I lied. But I'm glad, actually. It cleared the air. She was definitely pregnant. My stomach turned. Again, I felt as if I had forgotten something crucial. I had overlooked something and would pay for it. I'm sorry, Go said. She waited a few seconds. The fact of the matter is, I can't talk about it. I can't. Okay. I'm actually in New York, I said. I have an appointment with Tanner Bolt. She let out a whoosh of breath. Thank God. You were able to see him that quick? That's how fucked my case is. I'd been patched through at once to Tanner. I was on hold all of 3 seconds after stating my name. And when I told him about my living room interrogation, about the pregnancy, he ordered me to hop the next plane. I'm kind of freaking out, I added. You're doing the smart thing. Seriously. Another pause. His name can't really be Tanner Bolt, can it? I said, trying to make light. I heard it's an anagram for Ratner Tolb. Really? No. I laughed, an inappropriate feeling, but good. Then, from the far side of the room, the anagram was walking toward me. Black pinstriped suit and lime green tie, sharky grin. He walked with his hand out, in shake and strike mode. Nick Dunn, I'm Tanner Bolt. Come with me. Let's get to work. Tanner Bolt's office seemed designed to resemble the clubroom of an exclusive all-men's golf course. Comfortable leather chairs, shelves thick with legal books, a gas fireplace with flames flickering in the air conditioning. Sit down, have a cigar, complain about the wife, tell some questionable jokes. Just us guys here. Bolt deliberately chose not to sit behind his desk. He ushered me toward a two-man table as if we were going to play chess.
"This is a conversation for us partners," Bolt said without having to say it. "We'll sit at our little war room table and get down to it."
"My retainer, Mr. Dunn, is $100,000. That's a lot of money, obviously. So I want to be clear on what I offer and what I will expect of you, okay?"
He aimed unblinking eyes at me, a sympathetic smile, and waited for me to nod. Only Tanner Bolt could get away with making me, a client, fly to him, then tell me what kind of dance I'd need to do in order to give him my money.
"I win, Mr. Dunn. I win unwinnable cases, and the case that I think you may soon face is, I don't want to patronize you. It's a tough one. Money troubles, bumpy marriage, pregnant wife. The media has turned on you. The public has turned on you."
He twisted a signet ring on his right hand and waited for me to show him I was listening. I'd always heard the phrase, "At 40, a man wears the face he's earned." Bolt's 40-ish face was well-tended, almost wrinkle-free, pleasantly plump with ego. Here was a confident man, the best in his field, a man who liked his life.
"There will be no more police interviews without my presence," Bolt was saying. "That's something I seriously regret you did. But before we even get to the legal portion, we need to start dealing with public opinion. Because the way it's going, we have to assume everything is going to get leaked. Your credit cards, the life insurance, the supposedly staged crime scene, the mopped up blood. It looks very bad, my friend. And so it's a vicious cycle. The cops think you did it. They let the public know. The public is outraged. They demand an arrest. So one, we've got to find an alternative suspect. Two, we've got to keep the support of Amy's parents. I cannot emphasize that piece enough. And three, we've got to fix your image. Because should this go to trial, it will influence the juror pool. Change of venue doesn't mean anything anymore. 24-hour cable, internet, the whole world is your venue. So I cannot tell you how key it is to start turning this whole thing around."
"I'd like that too, believe me."
"How are things with Amy's parents? Can we get them to make a statement of support?"
"I haven't spoken with them since it was confirmed that Amy was pregnant."
"Is pregnant." Tanner frowned at me. "Is. She is pregnant. Never, ever mention your wife in the past tense."
"Fuck." I put my face in my palm for a second. I hadn't even noticed what I'd said.
"Don't worry about it with me," Bolt said, waving the air magnanimously. "But everywhere else, worry. Worry hard. From now on, I don't want you to open your mouth if you haven't thought it through. So you haven't spoken to Amy's parents." "I don't like that." "You've tried to get in touch, I assume?"
"I've left a few messages." Bolt scrawled something on a yellow legal pad.
"Okay, we have to assume this is bad news for us. But you need to track them down. Nowhere public, or some asshole with a camera phone can film you. We can't have another Shauna Kelly moment. Or send your sister in, a recon mission. See what's going on. Actually do that, that's better."
"Okay."
"I need you to make a list for me, Nick. Of all the nice things you've done for Amy over the years. Romantic things, especially in this past year. You cooked her chicken soup when she was sick, or you sent her love letters while you were on a business trip. Nothing too flashy. I don't care about jewelry unless you guys picked it out on vacation or something. We need real personal stuff here. Romantic movie stuff."
"What if I'm not the romantic movie kind of guy?" Tanner tightened his lips, then blew them back out.
"Come up with something, okay, Nick? You seem like a good guy.
I'm sure you did something thoughtful this past year. I couldn't think of a decent thing I'd done in the past 2 years. In New York, those first few years of marriage, I'd been desperate to please my wife, to return to those loose-limbed days when she'd run across a drugstore parking lot and leap into my arms, a spontaneous celebration of her hairspray purchase, her face pressed up against mine all the time, her bright blue eyes wide, and her yellow lashes catching on mine, the heat of her breath just under my nose, the silliness of it. For 2 years I tried as my old wife slipped away, and I tried so hard. No anger, no arguments, the constant kowtowing, the capitulation, the sitcom husband version of me. Yes, dear, of course, sweetheart. The fucking energy leached from my body as my frantic rabbit thoughts tried to figure out how to make her happy. And each action, each attempt, was met with a rolled eye or a sad little sigh. A you-just-don't-get-it sigh. By the time we left for Missouri, I was just pissed. I was ashamed of the memory of me, the scuttling, scraping, hunch-backed toady of a man I'd turned into. So I wasn't romantic. I wasn't even nice. Also, I need a list of people who may have harmed Amy, who may have had something against her. I should tell you, it seems Amy tried to buy a gun earlier this year.
The cops know?
Yes.
Did you know?
Not until the guy she tried to buy from told me. He took exactly 2 seconds to think.
Then I bet their theory is she wanted a gun to protect herself from you, he said. She was isolated. She was scared. She wanted to believe in you, yet she could feel something was very wrong. So she wanted a gun in case her worst fear was correct.
Wow, you're good.
My dad was a cop, he said. But I do like the gun idea. Now we just need someone to match it to besides you. Nothing is too far out. If she argued with the neighbor constantly over a barking dog, if she was forced to rebuff a flirty guy, whatever you got, I need. What do you know about Tommy O'Hara?
Right. I know he called the tip line a few times.
He was accused of date raping Amy in 2005.
I felt my mouth open, but I said nothing.
She was dating him casually. There was a dinner date at his place. Things got out of hand, and he raped her, according to my sources.
When in 2005?
May.
It was during the 8 months when I'd lost Amy. The time between our New Year's meeting and my finding her again on 7th Avenue. Tanner tightened his tie, twisted a diamond-studded wedding band, assessing me.
She never told you.
I haven't heard a single thing about this, I said. From anyone, but especially not from Amy.
You'd be surprised, the number of women who still find it a stigma. Ashamed.
I can't believe
I try never to show up to one of these meetings without new information for my client, he said. I want to show you how serious I am about your case, and how much you need me.
This guy could be a suspect?
Sure, why not? Tanner said too breezily. He has a violent history with your wife.
Did he go to prison?
She dropped the charges. Didn't want to testify, I assume. If you and I decide to work together, I'll have him checked out. In the meantime, think of anyone who took an interest in your wife. Better if it's someone in Carthage, though. More believable. Now,
Tanner crossed a leg, exposed his bottom row of teeth, uncomfortably bunched and stained in comparison with his perfect picket fence top row. He held his crooked teeth against his upper lip for a moment,
Now comes the harder part, Nick, he said. I need total honesty from you. It won't work any other way. So tell me everything about your marriage. Tell me the worst. Because if I know